Hello, and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. When President Donald Trump authorized the military strikes against three Iranian sites suspected as the key to that nation's attempt to build nuclear weapons, it also started a political firestorm back in the United States. The reaction from Democrats was immediate. Firebrand New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was perhaps the most direct in her response. In a post on her social media account on X, she wrote, "The president's disastrous decision to bomb Iran without authorization is a grave violation of the Constitution and congressional war powers. He has impulsively risked launching a war that may ensnare us for generations. It is absolutely and clearly grounds for impeachment." Other prominent Democrats followed in what was no doubt a coordinated message when they too called the attack unconstitutional, with many also calling for the impeachment of the president. However, there are a couple of questions that must be raised. Firstly, was this action unconstitutional? And secondly, what does the historical landscape look like regarding the use of the military by past presidents? This week we have a lot to unpack, and you may be surprised at what you find. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we get underway. To begin, we need to look at how the United States Constitution divides the responsibilities and the power of war-making. I use the term war-making because what we now call the Department of Defense was, up until the Cold War, known as the Department of War. That change was a propaganda move made to convince the world that the U.S. was never the aggressor in conflicts, as opposed to the Soviet Union, which was labeled an expansionist threat to world peace. But back to the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution provides a framework for the division of war powers between Congress and the President, a balance that has been continually contested throughout American history. While Congress holds the authority to declare war under Article 1, the President serves as the Commander-in-Chief under Article 2. This dual arrangement has led to persistent conflicts over the scope and limits of military authority. Under Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, Congress is empowered to declare war, raise and support armies, maintain a navy, and regulate the armed forces. These provisions suggest that the framers intended Congress to hold the predominant authority in initiating armed conflict. In contrast, Article 2, Section 2 designates the President as the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, granting the executive branch operational control of the military once war is authorized. The framers sought to balance the need for decisive military leadership with safeguards against executive overreach. Their recent experience with British tyranny informed their decision to place the power to declare war squarely in the hands of the legislature. Despite these clear textual assignments, the balance has often skewed toward presidential dominance, especially in the post-World War II era. While Congress retains formal authority, presidents have frequently initiated military actions without explicit declarations of war, relying on expansive interpretations of their commander-in-chief powers or outdated authorizations for use of military force, otherwise known as AUMFs. The practical result of this constitutional tug-of-war has been an increasingly assertive executive branch. Modern presidents have engaged in numerous military operations without congressional declarations of war, from Korea and Vietnam to Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Congress has frequently abdicated its role, either through silence or by passing broad AUMFs that are interpreted to authorize future unrelated actions. Of course, the reason Congress passes AUMFs instead of an official declaration of war is simple and purely political in nature. By doing so, members of Congress can have the best of both worlds. If military action is viewed by the public as necessary and successful, Congress gets to claim some measure of credit. However, if things go sideways, then they can put the blame on the executive branch for not adhering to the true intentions of the congressional authorization. On the other hand, an official declaration of war is the real deal and makes the members of Congress just as vested in the exercise as the president. The last declaration of war passed by Congress was in 1941 as the United States officially entered World War II. Since then, every action taken by the President has relied on some lesser form of congressional authorization, or none at all. The consequences of this process include a diminished role for democratic deliberation, the erosion of constitutional checks and balances, and a growing public disconnection from military decisions made on their behalf. The War Powers Resolution of 1973, also known as the War Powers Act, intended to curtail these trends. However, it has been largely symbolic, with presidents routinely circumventing its provisions. Currently, those in opposition to Trump's strikes on Iran have used the act as a fallback to their claims that the action was unconstitutional, claiming that the law states the president must consult with Congress before taking any military action. The War Powers Act was born out of the experience of the Vietnam War. It was enacted by the U.S. Congress to limit the president's ability to initiate or escalate military actions abroad without congressional approval. The key provisions of the law are as follows. The first involves presidential notification, specifically that the president must notify Congress within 48 hours of committing U.S. armed forces to military action. The second provision places a time limit on the use of the military. Troops cannot remain engaged in hostilities for more than 60 days, with an additional 30-day withdrawal period, without explicit congressional authorization or a declaration of war. Finally, there is a consultation requirement that the president must consult with Congress in every possible instance before introducing armed forces into hostilities. The act was intended to prevent the kind of incrementalism that dragged the country into a full-fledged war in Southeast Asia. The timeline of U.S. involvement in Vietnam bears this out. In 1954, forces under Communist leader Ho Chi Minh defeated the imperialist French military while fighting a war for their own independence. A year later, President Dwight Eisenhower deployed U.S. military advisors in South Vietnam to support the South Vietnamese government against communist insurgency. After succeeding Eisenhower as president, John F. Kennedy increased the number of advisors and special forces. By 1963, there were over 16,000 U.S. personnel in Vietnam. In August of 1964, unprovoked attacks on U.S. naval ships in the waters off North Vietnam, which later investigations raised questions about the accuracy of the reports, led to Congress passing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which gave President Lyndon Johnson the authority to conduct military operations without a formal declaration of war from Congress. A year later, Johnson deployed ground troops, and by 1968, the total number of American troops in Vietnam exceeded 500,000 personnel. Johnson's successor, Richard Nixon, expanded the theater to include neighboring countries Cambodia and Laos, but eventually, Nixon decreased the number of U.S. troops, and by 1973, the Paris Peace Accords were signed, and the last U.S. troops are withdrawn. Throughout the involvement in Vietnam, the U.S. fought a prolonged war without a formal congressional declaration. Instead, the executive branch relied on the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution and the president's commander-in-chief powers. Critics argue that this set a precedent for future military interventions carried out without explicit legislative authorization. The Vietnam War and its unchecked escalation galvanized congressional efforts to reclaim war powers. The result was the War Powers Resolution of 1973, passed over President Nixon's veto. The debate surrounding the act centered on reestablishing constitutional boundaries after years of executive overreach. Proponents saw the resolution as essential for restoring constitutional order. Critics, including Nixon and later presidents, argued it was an unconstitutional constraint on the executive. In practice, most presidents have viewed the act as advisory and found ways to bypass it, continuing the trend set during Vietnam. The tug of war between the presidency and Congress has continued. The practical result of this constitutional tug of war has been an increasingly assertive executive branch. Modern presidents have engaged in numerous military operations without congressional declarations of war, from Korea and Vietnam to Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Congress has frequently abdicated its role, either through silence or by passing broad AUMFs that are interpreted to authorize future, unrelated actions. Congress has not effectively enforced the act due to political divisions, lack of political will, or perceived public support for military actions. There have been multiple attempts to revise or repeal the War Powers Resolution, but none have succeeded. The act remains symbolically important in asserting congressional war powers, but its practical effectiveness is limited. It is important to understand that circumventing congressional authority and using military force is not something that started with the escalation of the Vietnam War. There is a narrative, one quite popular, that the United States is a nation that has deep isolationist roots. The country, according to this narrative, avoids military intervention and has done so since its founding. However, this assessment is hilariously inaccurate. The U.S. is not now, nor has it ever been, truly isolationist. When George Washington left office, he famously warned the new nation to avoid involvement in the affairs of Europe, and for good reason. European countries had been at war with each other since the end of the Ice Age, when they were all using stone points on wooden spears. Washington understood that alliances with European powers would include involvement in European wars. For the most part, the U.S. avoided European entanglements until the early 20th century. However, there was the near-constant warfare directed at the indigenous nations that found themselves inside the nation's borders. Borders drawn up by European treaties made with little or no input from native peoples. During Washington's administration, he had U.S. troops fighting a war against Native American confederacies to enforce treaties, or break them, with military force. Washington wasn't alone. James Madison fought the first Seminole War that allowed Andrew Jackson to lead military incursions into what was Spanish Florida. Later, as President Jackson and his successor Martin Van Buren forced the Cherokee off their homeland. In fact, according to historical data from the U.S. Treasury Department, the annual federal budget used to prosecute wars with indigenous nations, starting with Washington in 1790 and ending with the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890, ranged anywhere from 20 to 40% of the total federal budget. Once the federal government could no longer look inward, it turned its gaze outward and truly became a global imperialist country. The first step was the Spanish-American War, which began under questionable circumstances when an explosion sank the battleship USS Maine in Havana Harbor, and ended with the United States acquiring several Spanish colonies, including Cuba and Puerto Rico in the Caribbean, and the Philippines and Guam in the Western Pacific. When it comes to discussing U.S. interventions in the Western Hemisphere, it requires a brief explanation of the Monroe Doctrine, because it is invoked by every president who has interfered with the internal affairs of other nations in the region. Introduced in 1823, it remains one of the most influential foreign policy principles in United States history. Originally intended to deter European intervention in the Americas, it evolved over the 19th and 20th centuries into a justification for U.S. regional dominance and intervention, especially in Latin America. President James Monroe first articulated the Monroe Doctrine in his annual message to Congress on December 2, 1823. Though Monroe delivered the address, the doctrine's intellectual foundation was largely developed by his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. The policy was born amid fears of renewed European colonial ambitions following the Napoleonic Wars and the restoration of monarchies in Spain and France. The doctrine emerged in the wake of significant political shifts. Many Latin American countries had recently declared independence from Spain, and there was concern that European powers, especially through the Holy Alliance, might support Spain in efforts to reconquer its colonies. Britain, too, opposed European intervention due to its growing commercial interests in Latin America. Although some U.S. leaders considered a joint declaration with Britain, Adams opposed this, favoring an independent American stance. Monroe asserted, "The American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers." The doctrine's core principles included non-colonization, non-intervention by European powers in the Western Hemisphere, and U.S. neutrality in European internal affairs. Because the United States lacked the military strength to deter European aggression in Central and South America, the reality was, it was a toothless proclamation that was more symbolic than substantial. However, as the U.S. became the preeminent military power in the Western Hemisphere at the end of the 19th century, and a global power by the early 20th century, presidents invoked and modified the doctrine to justify proactive U.S. intervention in Latin America. President Theodore Roosevelt introduced a significant reinterpretation in what became known as the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. He declared that in cases of chronic wrongdoing or instability, the U.S. had the right to intervene in Latin American nations to maintain order. He stated, "Chronic wrongdoing may force the United States to the exercise of an international police power." This marked a transition from a passive doctrine of hemispheric separation to a proactive policy of intervention. Historians and scholars have long debated the true intentions and consequences of the Monroe Doctrine. While it was framed as a defensive policy, many scholars view it as a tool of imperialism. Historian Jay Sexton argues, though born of defensive aims, the Monroe Doctrine became a license for American imperialism. This shift became particularly evident with the Roosevelt corollary and 20th century interventions. Historian and Yale professor Greg Grandin provides a more critical interpretation, stating, "The Monroe Doctrine was less about protecting Latin America from Europe than it was about asserting U.S. hegemony." Latin American intellectuals and leaders have historically viewed the doctrine as a mask for economic and military domination. Somewhat lost in all of this is the fact that the Monroe Doctrine is not international law, nor is it a treaty negotiated and signed by other nations. It is simply a statement of the paradigm of U.S. foreign policy. Nevertheless, presidents have treated it like it was some sacred text scribed by a higher power, and the list of military actions in Latin America, especially since Theodore Roosevelt, is exhausting. Here is a list of U.S. military involvement, starting with the turn of the 20th century, that was not authorized by a congressional declaration of war. Following the end of the Spanish-American War, President William McKinley had troops fighting a war in the Philippines to crush the Filipinos' push for independence. He also sent U.S. troops to China to fight in the Boxer Rebellion, an uprising in China attempting to drive out Western influence. President Roosevelt supported a revolution in Panama against Colombia in 1903, using the U.S. Navy to prevent the Colombian government from putting down the rebellion in order to secure U.S. rights to build the Panama Canal. Roosevelt also used the military to force the Dominican Republic to pay on their debts owed to foreign investors starting in 1905. Political unrest in Cuba in 1906 was met by Roosevelt sending in the U.S. Marines to occupy Cuba. That occupation lasted until 1909. Roosevelt dispatched Navy gunboats to Haiti in 1905 to protect U.S. interests. Although no formal occupation took place, it laid the groundwork for future intervention in Haiti. Finally, in 1907, Roosevelt sent U.S. naval forces to Honduras to protect U.S. interests during a conflict between Honduras and Nicaragua. Moving on to Roosevelt's successor, William Howard Taft deployed over 2,000 U.S. Marines to Nicaragua to facilitate regime change to protect U.S. interests. That occupation would last intermittently until 1933. In Honduras, Taft used U.S. Marines to protect the business interests of the United Fruit Company. Taft sent U.S. Marines and sailors back to Cuba to protect U.S. interests in 1909. Finally, Taft deployed a U.S. naval force to the Dominican Republic to put pressure on the country, promising intervention would follow further instability. Woodrow Wilson followed Taft. In April 1914, the U.S. Navy occupied Veracruz after a minor incident, the Tampico Affair. The occupation lasted 7 months and resulted in over 300 Mexican and 19 American deaths. In 1916, following Pancho Villa's raid on Columbus, New Mexico, Wilson authorized the punitive expedition into northern Mexico, led by General John J. Pershing, involving 10,000 U.S. troops. After a period of political turmoil, the assassination of the Haitian president in July 1915 triggered Wilson to order the U.S. occupation of Haiti. U.S. Marines landed in Port-au-Prince, disbanded the Haitian legislature, and imposed a new U.S. written constitution, which allowed foreign land ownership, which was previously banned. The occupation involved direct military rule, suppression of local resistance, and the use of forced labor for infrastructure projects. The occupation lasted until 1934 and became a major symbol of American imperialism in the Caribbean. In the Dominican Republic, political instability and conflict between rival factions led Wilson to deploy Marines in 1916 to restore order. The U.S. dissolved the Dominican government and imposed a military government under Rear Admiral Harry Shepard Knapp. U.S. forces controlled the country's finances, customs, police, and infrastructure. Armed resistance from Dominican nationalists continued for years. The occupation officially ended in 1924, but left behind a U.S.-trained National Guard, later used by dictator Rafael Trujillo. In 1917, U.S. Marines were deployed in Cuba during the Little War of 1917, a brief insurgency against the pro-U.S. president, Mario Garcia Menocal, who had just secured a controversial re-election. Marines remained in Cuba until 1922 to safeguard order and U.S. business interests during World War I. Though U.S. Marines first arrived in 1912 under Taft, Wilson continued and expanded the occupation to ensure the success of the Bryan-Chamorro Treaty of 1914, which gave the U.S. exclusive rights to build a canal and establish military bases. Marines helped suppress opposition and maintained order to protect American banking and banana interests. The Marines became the de facto enforcers for the United Fruit Company in Latin America, and it is where the derisive term banana republics originated. The occupation would continue for most of the 1920s and into the early 1930s. Wilson sent U.S. troops to Colon and Panama City to maintain order during political instability following contested elections in Panama. The intervention was justified as necessary to protect the Panama Canal Zone, which was of enormous strategic value to the United States. U.S. naval vessels and Marines were sent to Honduras to influence the outcome of civil war and election disputes in 1919 and 1920. Though no full-scale occupation occurred, the presence of U.S. forces helped broker a political agreement favorable to American business interests, particularly the United Fruit Company. The Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge administrations in the 1920s were just as busy. U.S. Marines, stationed since 1912, remained in Nicaragua throughout the Harding and Coolidge years. In 1924, the U.S. attempted to broker free elections, but political tensions erupted into violence in 1926 when liberal forces rebelled against the U.S.-backed conservative government. Coolidge ordered the reoccupation of Managua in early 1927, with more than 2,000 Marines deployed. In 1927, General Augusto César Sandino launched a guerrilla war against U.S. forces and the puppet regime. His resistance would last until 1933. Henry Stimson, Coolidge's personal envoy, brokered the Espino-Negro Agreement of 1927, but the U.S. remained heavily involved in selecting Nicaraguan leadership. The U.S. formed and trained the Nicaraguan National Guard, a key tool in propping up later dictator Anastasio Somoza. Coolidge also ordered U.S. Marines to land in Honduras in 1924 to protect the interests of the United Fruit and Standard Fruit Companies. The occupation of Haiti continued unabated under both presidents. In the Dominican Republic, occupation was finally ended during the Coolidge years. In Panama, Harding sent troops to mediate a boundary dispute between Panama and Costa Rica in 1921. In 1925, U.S. Marines were deployed to Colon and Panama City during a strike by banana workers and port employees. The strike was seen as a threat to U.S. interests and canal security. U.S. troops remained until order was restored and workers' demands were crushed. In 1928 in Colombia, fear of U.S. military intervention led to the massacre of possibly more than 2,000 striking workers and their families as soldiers fired machine guns into a crowd, which included women and children. The strike against United Fruit was considered a threat to U.S. business interests. The bodies of the thousands brutally murdered were never recovered and are believed to be either buried in mass graves or were simply dumped into the sea. While no U.S. troops were involved, the U.S. government, through the State Department, pressured the Colombian government to brutally crush the strike. During the Cold War, following World War II, U.S. presidents continued to order military operations in Latin American countries and elsewhere. Truman fought the Korean War. Eisenhower used the CIA to remove elected Guatemalan president Jacobo Arbenz. He also deployed U.S. Marines to Lebanon in the Middle East. After the Vietnam years, Reagan sent Marines to Lebanon, bombed Libya, and invaded the Caribbean nation of Grenada. George Bush Sr. invaded Panama, fought the Gulf War known as Desert Storm in the Middle East, and sent the military to Somalia. Clinton ordered military strikes against Iraq, Bosnia and Kosovo, Sudan, Afghanistan, and occupied Haiti. George W. Bush invaded both Afghanistan and Iraq following the attacks on September 11th. Barack Obama bombed more people and places than can be listed on this podcast, and all of those examples since the beginning of the 20th century have the same thing in common. None of them were preceded by a congressional declaration of war. In the cases since the passage of the War Powers Act in 1973, some were authorized by Congress by the passage of an AUMF, but none of them followed a declaration of war as spelled out by the Constitution. Here is the point of all of this. The argument that Donald Trump's actions are unconstitutional and grounds for impeachment are laughable, but worse than that, they are destructive. There are many reasons to oppose military action against Iran. People can and should debate its necessity. There are valid concerns about an escalation dragging the country into another war in the Middle East, or the cost in terms of both lives and money. Would the trillions of dollars that would be poured into a prolonged conflict be worth it? Is this a war for our security, or one at the behest of Israel? And is that a war where the U.S. should get involved? And make no mistake, this is a debate that U.S. political leaders need to have, in full view of the public, but it is impossible to have an intelligent debate from a position of sheer ignorance. Rather than have that debate, the news media is pushing or refuting the unconstitutional narrative. As for your host, I am in no way supporting or condemning the latest actions by Trump. I am simply pointing out the history behind the presidential use of military force. The stated purpose of this podcast is to tie current events or issues to the historical past to create a deeper understanding of what we are facing in the present. The media is woefully inadequate when it comes to in-depth reporting. The reasons will be debated by future historians, but in the meantime, the public must demand more from the political class than ignorant narratives and look beyond news media driven by rage bait headlines that trade journalistic integrity for ad revenue clicks. As for this week's episode, if you found it informative or entertaining or both, please subscribe wherever you find this podcast. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see covered, please leave a comment on the podcast. Finally, show notes and a list of sources can always be found at the show blog at rootoftoday.blog. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week as we go back to the topic of immigration and take a look at the deportations under the Eisenhower administration. And because someone will once again propose a guest worker program, we will also talk about the Bracero program that was in effect from the middle of World War II until its end in 1964. Until next time, this is Alan, your host, signing off.